Hi everyone, welcome back to Rewatchable. This is episode 187. We're deep into our rewatch of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel. So we're up to Buffy season 4, episode 21, Primeval, and Angel season 1, 21, Blind Date. I am your host this week, Natalie. I am obviously not one of the usual hosts that you all hear on Rewatchable. I am a super fan, and we have three newbies joining me today. We've got Ariana, Brittany, and Kristen. It's going to be an interesting ride because I barely remembered these episodes until I watched them either, so it's almost like you've got four newbies. So that'll be fun. If you want to get in touch with us about these episodes or anything in the past or future that we've talked about, keeping it relatively spoiler-free for our newbies, you can reach out to us on our email address, which is rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com, our Twitter, which is re_watchable. You can comment on the post on hyperbole.com where we host the podcast, or you can go and join us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. So before we kick off the recaps of these two episodes that we watched this week, we'll just do our little fun fact intro in order to get to know our voices with each other. So there is myself, Natalie, there is Kristen, Brittany, and Ariana. Brittany, I would love you to go first, given that you put so much work into preparing your fun fact this week.
I did put a lot of effort into this fun fact. So I'm driving home from work on Friday, or no, to work on Friday, and I load up the latest episode of The West Wing Weekly because I saved it for the Friday morning commute, and I'm pulling up to my office, and I still have time to kill, so I'm listening to it in my car, and the end of this week, it's the episode where they're talking about Galileo, which is season 2 episode of The West Wing, and they get to the end of the episode. Rishi and Josh are doing a little bit of listener feedback, and the Joshua Molina from Scandal is having a problem with Gail H., a commenter who accuses them of getting too nitpicky about the show and ruining it for them. So I am sitting in my car, tuned in completely to this conversation.
Being like, I feel you.
And Josh starts to read the comment, and he goes, and he said that Gail H. says, "Finally going to unsubscribes, the host, namely Joshua Molina, feels the need to pick apart and find fault with each episode. I love the premise, and I think Josh should remove himself from this podcast."
Oh!
Now, I feel for Josh, because I, too, have been asked to leave. Well, it was suggested that maybe I should stop watching the show.
Oh, yeah.
But they both attacked comments a different way, Rishi and Josh. Rishi says on Facebook he replied to a person who was feeling the same way, that he thinks that he loves the show so much, The West Wing. He signed on to talk about the show for 3 years. That's how much he loves it. And his nitpickiness comes from a place of love, and it really enhances his viewing experience, because when the show is on top, then it's really on top. And the more he finds these little faults in it, it highlights the greater points of the show. And Josh went on to say, "Yes, I will acknowledge when Rob Lowe's hair is at a 2, because when it's at a 10, it really shines." And I'm like, all right, I get this logic. God. And I felt so validated as a host. And I just feel really, I felt really good about it. But Josh went after Gail H., called her out on some stuff. I will never respond to a listener like that. So that's the only place I don't agree with his tactics.
We do love our listeners, but there are some Gail H.'s out there in the world. We know them.
I love that you found validation in the podcasting community, and I'm sure it happens to everyone. I've been worried about you because I don't want you to watch something you don't like because I love you, if you know what I mean. Like, I've been worried. I'm like, don't put yourself through this if you don't want to, Brittany. But I love podcasting with you about Buffy, and I feel like it's making me smarter and more critical of something that I honestly liked very immaturely, I think, as a teenager. So I really enjoy having you on Buffy, and I love how much you love Angel, so I'd never want you to leave for that. But I have worried that you were like, hate, like, making yourself miserable. So I hope that you're not making yourself miserable. That's
no,
all.
No, I'm not.
Hate watching is its own joy.
It really is. Hate. And I don't think I'm hate watching. I think it might get better. Well, I hope it gets better. But now that we're through season 4 and I picked season 4 apart, I'm happy to say I loved seasons 1 through 3 in hindsight, like comparative to the Comparative to what we just watched.
Yeah. Wow. I was like, what were we complaining about before? Jeez.
I know. Like, how bad must they have been? Like, and then we get to 4 and I'm like, wow, 1 through 3, this show shined.
I am a big, as I've mentioned before, I'm a big fan of 5 to 7. There's usually people that like 1 to 3 or 5 to 7 and no one likes 4. That's kind of the standard. The standard for Buffy is you either like the old era or the newest, like the final era, and everyone hates 4. 4 was actually better than I remembered in this watch because I was expecting to hate it so much because everyone hates it. So I'm curious to see if both you and I enjoy the final 3 seasons in the way that I remember enjoying them because, yeah, we'll see. That's definitely my preferred era of Buffy is the later era. Ariana, do you have a fun fact in any way equal to Brittany's this
Not
week or anything related?
In any way equal. So mine is that today I went to go see Fantastic Beasts. Yes, Fantastic Beasts. And my birthday is next week, and I'm going to have a Harry Potter party, and it's going to be fabulous. So I'm taking suggestions for ideas for Harry Potter parties.
I'm just going to apparate into the party, so get
ready. Yes, please.
That sounds good. Yeah.
I think that we should ask Rewatchable to crowdfund a meeting between Ariana and Brittany.
I kind of like the idea that we're the same person because
that this is all a
ruse.
No
one has ever seen both of us at the same time.
Nope. You're just really good at throwing your voice like a ventriloquist.
Yep.
Which one is the real person, though? That is the real question. Or does neither one of us exist and there's just a third person who's pretending to be both of us?
Oh, my God. I haven't had a birthday party in many, many years, so I don't really remember what happens. But I hope it is fun and that you have lots of, I don't know, what kind of things do you want? Food or costumes or everything?
Food, mostly.
Karen and I made a Hogwarts-style feast and put it on plates right around, was that Halloween or was that? I think it was around Halloween. And we made, like, the little drumsticks so that we could be Ron and eat them with 2 hands. And we made mashed potatoes and, like, it was really cute. It was a little mini feast, but we made a bunch of stuff and it was fun. So you can always just do that if you can't find, like, quirky foods that actually, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to force everyone to take a sorting test, the Pottermore one, so we can stop with all the people who pretend they're Gryffindors.
See, I've taken that damn test 3 times now, and I've gotten 3 different
results. The first time is the only time that counts.
Okay, thank God, because that's the only one that actually matters to me. It told me I was a Slytherin the second time.
No, the first time is the only time it counts.
The second time I took it, when they redid it, it made me a Slytherin, and I'm the least Slytherin person in the world, I'm pretty sure.
I got Gryffindor the first time. I think I've only taken it once, like I'm talking years ago, like 2012. And I don't know if I agree with it. Others have said they agree with it. I don't know if I agree with it.
But I got Ravenclaw the first time, which is accurate. Slytherin is not.
I mean, we all know what I got.
Kristen, do you have a fun fact for this week? Anything special?
Well, you know, my life isn't as much fun because Karen went home for Thanksgiving, so now I'm all by myself. But I did get to take down all of the Halloween decorations. Yes, I did so last night after she left.
Yes.
And I have already started Christmas decorating, and it is so much fun. When she comes back, it's going to be like Christmas Wonderland, and I'm very excited about this. I decorated Halloween while she was gone last time, so I told her that I wouldn't make her take the Halloween stuff down. I would take it down while she was gone, and then just Christmas would arrive, and when she gets back after Thanksgiving, it'll just be here already.
Why does she hate Christmas so much?
She doesn't hate Christmas. She just hates it when Christmas starts, like, before Thanksgiving. Like, okay. She wants it to have its place, like, from Thanksgiving to Christmas, and then once Christmas is done, it's done. Little does she know, our tree is going to be up until at least February. Last year, I think we took it down in April, May, or March or April, so, you know.
When you think about it from, like, a really abstract perspective, decorating for holidays is freaking extremely strange. Like, yeah, let's just bring a tree inside our house and like dance around it. Like, that's not like witchy at all. Like, it's really strange that we like do this to ourselves, and like that it makes us feel anything at all to have decorations just randomly, you know, like, oh, our house is decorated to a theme for a holiday. Like, sometimes I sit there and I'm like, it's really weird. This is a real, because near me, or I don't know if it's all over the world, but in the last couple of years, I've seen a lot of Easter decorations. Like, decoration companies are trying to cash in on decorating, and they're like, oh, we're going to make Easter decorations. You don't decorate for Easter. No. But apparently in the last few years, you do. They make Easter wreaths, and it's like a little wreath with like freaking painted eggs stuck to it. And I'm not okay with it, basically, that we apparently have to decorate for every holiday. It's really strange. And I enjoy the Christmas decorations. I'm like, oh, how charming. Look at what we've done. How nice. And I don't understand, like, why it's a thing that we do, though.
Yeah. It's just magical. There's something about the Christmas lights in the tree, and when you turn off all the lights and that's the only source of light, it's just, it's soothing and calming, and it's lovely. That's its purpose. And there's very little dancing around said tree. No, there's a present opening, very little dancing.
Well, my fun fact can also be Christmas related, and it will be that I am going to have a winter Christmas for the first time in 10 years. And it will be my second ever only winter Christmas, as I'm going to go to London for Christmas this year. So I don't know what happens at Christmas when it's cold. If I'm going to have to be cold and miss out on my summer vacation here, I want the Christmas in Northern Hemisphere to be like as charming and twee as it possibly can be. I've been in New York in January, and that was like, you would wake up and there was a foot of snow. Like,
oh yeah. And then JFK's like, whatever.
That's like the coldest I've ever been, like the coldest I've ever lived in, if you know what I mean. Like, oh, we have to get up and like walk out and this and prepare for it every day. Okay, that's weird. So that's the most I've ever dealt with. But yeah, what happens at Christmas when it's cold? Because in Australia, you go to the beach.
I mean, I don't know what to do. You drink hot chocolate and you go shopping and you sit around Christmas trees and you go see Santa. I mean, you do all the same stuff.
You do ice skating.
Ice skating.
That's the thing I want to do. I want to do ice skating out the front of like one of the, you know, how in London, if you've seen, they put it like, you know, in the palace or the, you know,
the museum. Natural History like, Museum does it.
Yeah, I would like to do that.
Yeah, so do that. Other than that, it's pretty much everything you would probably do minus the hot beverages and a jacket.
Anyway, moving on from Christmas, I think. And
this is a Buffy Gale, podcast.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We watched episode 421, Primeval, which is the penultimate episode of season 4. So in this episode, Adam unleashes his all-out war on the Initiative. When the Scoobies try to warn the Colonel that the captive demons are about to be let out, he ignores them, so he dies along with tons of the Initiative. Meanwhile, the Scoobies become magically one as Buffy and Riley explode and rip the heart out of Demon Forest and Adam, respectively. He means respectively, doesn't he? He's putting respectfully. Yeah.
No, yeah, they did this with great respect.
They respectfully rip the heart out of Demon Forest and Adam. The remainder of the Initiative is disbanded with its remains left to be filled in with concrete. Yeah, basically this episode is what we'd call the finale of the Initiative plot. Like, this is the big ending hurrah of Adam and creepy Maggie Walsh, and they get to fill the bunker with concrete and stuff like that. So this is the end of the season. So I guess the big question is what happens in a finale in the actual episode 22 next week, like, if it's not anything to do with this story. So how did you guys feel about this, and do you have any theories about what might happen, like given that everything was kind of like quote unquote like closed off or finished off in this episode? So
it was really confusing. I mean, I think I was like, oh, did they realize that this season was terrible, and they were like, we better set it up for next season so that they know to come back. This was so anticlimactic.
It was, and it really didn't feel like it wrapped up the season. I was just like, oh, all right, I guess this is done. That's cool. Because Adam never felt like a threat. And so to have this ending and then it be like, oh, this is the penultimate episode, then either something big is coming. And like Ariana said, they really have to set something up. And also, they're just trying to make this season last forever to torture us, because I cannot believe I have to watch one more season four episode. I just really can't believe it.
I mean, my only thought for where we go from here is we still have to deal with Spike. I'm assuming that either the implant is going to be gone
But they decided to deal with him because he, like, saved their life.
Right.
And so but, like, they're just like, oh, whatever.
God knows what Spike could be.
I don't know why they're so, like, whatever with Spike. Probably because he's so charming.
Yeah. We'll get to Spike because he's a pretty big part of this episode with his, you know, he's a huge part in causing the problems. But because he didn't actually do anything himself, we revisit that idea of that they just kill him in cold blood as a punishment as opposed to in a fight. Then they look too harsh or whatever. So I think that's still where we're at with him. I guess Mitch, or possibly Ariana, has added that this might be what Game of Thrones does. Like, was this your comment or Mitch's, Ariana?
No, that was Mitch's. I did not know he watches Game of Thrones.
Neither did I. This is why I'm like,
good for Mitch. Surprise.
But big penultimate episode set up for the next season in the finale, which is a habit of Game of Thrones. And oh, Jesus, the last two episodes of the last season of Game of Thrones were unbelievably good. Some of the best episodes of television ever. Buffy ain't got nothing on Game of Thrones, so I'm not sure why we are comparing. But yeah, it's certainly not the norm for Buffy to do this. It's certainly not the norm for Buffy to have the finale be something new as opposed to being the big finishing point of that year's drama. So
Once Upon a Time does this every season. They always have a 2-hour finale. Everything is wrapped up in the first hour and the second hour is spent setting up the next season. So the format is familiar to me as a Once Upon a Time viewer, but like you said, it hasn't happened on Buffy yet, and Buffy's finales, from what I've heard so far, are like the best episodes, and is seen by everyone wanting to be on next week's episode. So, and that's really not a finale though. I feel like we're starting over going into next week.
It's a good point, and yeah, what you said about Once Upon a Time, I think Supernatural does the same thing pretty strongly, in that every season of Buffy it's kind of got a start and an end, and it's like closed off and it's a new drama. Teen Wolf is very similar. It's a start and an end. It's like closed off, new story next year. Whereas Supernatural, and it sounds like Once Upon a Time as well, usually the drama of a season is the child, the brainchild of whatever the fallout from the last season's finale was, if you know what I mean, rather than solving a problem and then having something new, which is what Buffy has been doing. It solves the problem, has something new, solves the problem, has something new. Supernatural has felt like one story from the beginning to the end, because every finale is like, oh, we caused another problem that's going to be the entire plot of the next season. So is that kind of like what Once Upon a Time does, or?
Yeah, I mean, the seasons themselves are very, like, the finale of last season opens the door for the season. So, like, for example, last season they ended in, where were they even, Kristen? I can't even remember.
Well, they came back from the underworld.
Right,
and immediately ended up in the Land of Untold Stories. Which we knew nothing about until we came back this season.
Yeah, so like the first hour was spent wrapping up the underworld, and then the second hour they magically opened a portal to get rid of the fluff they had left over from the first half of the season, and they fell through another portal into another land, which is then the kicking off point for this season.
That sounds confusing, but yes, Buffy's certainly more of the type that has the self-contained arc for the season. So for this to happen is certainly a new thing. And there is a very... Next week's episode is one of the most unusual episodes of not just this show, but of television that I've ever seen. I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but it is one of the most unusual. So that's kind of why you would have seen everyone jumping to want to be on it. So this is the follow-up to the Yoko Factor. It's like to be continued, like literally the second half of the episode. How did you guys like the Yoko Factor, just quickly? Did you hate it? Did you love it? I personally remembered liking the concept of like Spike going around and doing all of that, but I did not remember that it was like a two-parter that was left unresolved. I thought that it was just like a funny comedy episode that I didn't realize how much of a big deal it ended up being. So
I hated the Yoko factor so much that actually, like, when I watched this one, I was like, oh, this is much better.
What did you hate about it in a very brief summary?
I hated that it, like, brought out the worst in all three of them. Mm. Which, I mean, I feel like I talked about this last week, how I don't like any of them. But it brought out really the worst in all of them. And this episode, they finally came together again, which was a relief because they are pretty unbearable on their own. But when they're together, at least they're, like, nice to each other. And so they're much easier to like. So I much preferred this episode.
Really interesting because my main thought when I did kind of watch this and realized how tied to the Yoko factor it was, that my vague memories were like the Yoko factor, as I said, where it was a self-contained, like, comedy bit rather than an important plot point, was that this, did you guys find this at all heavy-handed? The kind of, like, literal, like, oh, look at how much stronger we are together as a counterpoint to the separation and the Yoko factor? Because it, to me, was very heavy-handed, but I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing.
It's definitely heavy-handed. They literally came together. It's not like they worked together.
Well, we're much stronger together.
It's been such a bad season. It's been such a bad season that I kind of felt like it was needed for them to admit, like, hey, we haven't been great this season. That's what I felt like they were telling us. Like, we know. We got to get back to the basics.
Yeah, I definitely agree, especially because they make a point to be like, sorry, I really haven't talked to you for this whole season. I kind of went off on my own and did my own thing and kept some secrets and, you know, it's fine. So, like, the first thing that came to my mind when you were asking if it was heavy-handed, I'm like, I feel like this is going to be one of those things we're going to be like, this is classic season four. Like, just like, I feel like anytime this sort of plot line happens going forward, I'm just going to be like, oh, that's such a season four thing to do.
Yeah, how do you feel about that with shows in general when, like, something like a supernatural show like this, like an element of the supernatural where, like, the monster or the magical solution, like, reflects the emotional place, like as a storytelling device. Do you like that, or do you, like, can they just be normal and then also have magic and demons on the side?
I don't mind that. I think that, all right, I do mind it a little bit. I mind it when it's, like, not a, like, a bottle episode type thing, like, where, you know, it's monster of the week, that monster of the week is affecting the story and driving the story that's going on and happening, as opposed to, like, you know, it taking away from a story. So if it's a self-contained sort of like a procedural, like, oh, we're doing a case this week and, you know, we need to get this, we need to hit X, Y, and Z points with Xander, Buffy, and Willow, but we can have this one monster bring out all of that, then that's fine. As long as you move on from it. If you're trying to tell a bigger overarching story, like I feel like they were trying to do with season four, it didn't hit the mark. And I think that's why I appreciate seasons 1 through 3 so much more now, because I liked that, you know, I felt something from each of the characters every week. And I think that the supernatural monster of the week had stuff to do with that. You know,
when it was like they were bringing something out. Oh, it's a metaphor for how he feels about his life.
Yeah, and I don't mind that. Yeah. You know, that doesn't bother me, especially when I know the alternative, they can't pull it off.
Wow.
Well, I think that the overarching story thing going on here is so disconnected from everything else that you just don't care. I honestly could care less about Adam. The initiative was cool, and, like, Buffy working with the initiative was kind of interesting, but this whole Adam thing, I still don't remember how or why he came to be, and I don't really care to. Like, he was pointless. He showed up a couple of times, pretended to be bad, and then was killed. I think that's the part, like, having that as the overarching story just kind of was a giant letdown, because we never really got Adam's story, and so why should we care?
Let's talk about what might have made it better. Given the concept of the initiative existing, Maggie, I guess Riley, and the concept of the government and Maggie Walsh's project and everything that we kind of learned, you know, that we saw this episode, what would have been a better story for them to do with these resources?
I feel like if they would have made the difference between Buffy and her being, like, the chosen one and her having, like, a birthright to fight this kind of evil versus the initiative being a government-run organization that's testing on them because of this and that. I feel like if they would have focused on the dynamics of those two forces, like either going up against each other or working together and then, you know, not finding common ground ending up working against each other, I think that would have worked better. But like ultimately by the end, everybody that made any sort of an impact on us at the initiative was dead.
Yeah.
Except for Riley. And Adam was this looming evil presence created by the initiative, but he really wasn't a part of the initiative.
What did he even want to do? Like, what was Adam's plan? I still don't really understand.
His plan was like Maggie Walsh's plan, and she died, and it was like, wait, what? So it just got kind of muddled up in its own mess. If they would have just kept what they had going between Buffy and the Scoobies and the initiative, that was kind of interesting.
The season started off with a theme and they never quite delivered on it. Like, it seemed like it was magic versus technology.
Yeah.
Or like the old ways versus the new ways, because we got that kind of with like Giles as her mentor versus Maggie as her mentor and things like that. And they could have done something interesting with that versus like, is Buffy relevant anymore if there's like big tanks out there? So,
and it literally would have been enough, in my opinion, just the sheer fact of them discovering other humans that know about the supernatural, if you know what I mean. Even that discovery of like all of the different underground worlds that know about the supernatural. Obviously, in Angel, we've seen a lot of different elements of people who know about the supernatural. Gunn and his like group of hunters, like all of that kind of thing, you know, Wolfram and Hart, which we'll talk about in the next episode. But this is one of the first encounters that Buffy's had with big groups of people that know about the world that she's in and a higher government run, like, awareness that the government knows about it. Like, how is that not enough compared to, oh, crazy ladies building a Frankenstein? You know, like, why?
The government also never tried to trap Buffy, which is bizarre. Like, that seems like that should have been the finale. Like, the government tries to trap Buffy,
and then her
friends have to try and get her out.
You know, like, Captain America Civil War, that it would have been like, oh, even if she wasn't considered a supernatural creature, that she might have been, oh, government control, you have to go fight that, you have to go do that, you know, that kind of thing. That concept that, you know, people outside the Slayer world of like, oh, Buffy, you know, the Watchers Council and stuff like that, that there are these huge groups of people that know about, you know, what she's doing, or at least not about her specifically because they thought she was a myth, but the supernatural world, and that even they could have made a story from that. I don't know why Adam had to happen, but there we go. What actually happened was that, you know, Riley, at the end of the last episode, Forrest is dead. Riley walks off, apparently, because he's got this chip in him, a control chip presumably planted by Maggie because she was creepy as hell and wanted to like mother these men or like keep them as pets or have sex with them, something. I don't know. There was a lot of weirdness going on with her relationship with Adam and Riley, and basically Adam is able to control Riley, at least physically, in some way. That was fun, and by fun I mean gross. I don't know, that ongoing thing with Adam's lair and all of the people that he reanimated, none of that really made a ton of sense to me in terms of what was going on, what the aim was, what he was trying to do.
I think that that's a huge part of what we were saying. It's like Adam came and went. Yeah, they were leaving breadcrumbs for us to follow, but we lost track of them because they were trying to tell way too many stories at once. So you have the whole setup of this group of friends that we've come to know who are very close thrown into a new environment. They're not quite sure what their place is. They, you know, you have Giles who doesn't know what to do with his life. You have Xander who doesn't know what to do with his life. You have Anya who's trying to cling to Xander. You have Tara trying to come into the mix, and Willow going through this whole new self-discovery process, and there's not enough time given to any of them. So by the time you get to any one character, you're just like, oh, well, you know, why am I supposed to care about this at this moment when I've finally started caring about something else, and now we're going to spend 3 episodes here? So, and I think Adam is a huge part of that. Like, I cared about him when he woke up and when he killed those kids. And then he was gone for like 5 to 7 episodes. And so now I'm just like, oh, so he's been hiding underground and he realized that there are some chips in people's heads. Like, it just doesn't do anything for me. So whenever they're on screen, I'm like, well, I don't really care what your point is because I know you're going away in this episode, kind of.
Well, the gang all have their heavy-handed makeup and they decide to go infiltrate the initiative for, again, reasons that honestly, if you like put a gun to my head and you were like, why are they doing this? What were they trying to do in there? I'd be like, shut it down, question mark. They were trying to get to the secret base that Adam had that was not on the official initiative maps where he was doing all of his nonsense. So they were doing that. Buffy and Willow make up because after they all realize that everyone has been lied to by Spike, and they basically make this plan to go into the initiative. And as they're abseiling down the wall, Buffy and Willow have this big heart-to-heart about, like, all of the trauma Willow was going through for being scared because she was apparently gay now and all of that. So that conversation is not one that I loved, I'm not going to lie. And I promise there's going to be some positivity soon because I loved this episode of Angel. But
that's really interesting. Can you talk about why you didn't love it?
That scene between them?
Yeah.
I know that this was like 15 years ago or whatever, but number one, it was all kind of swept under the rug in terms of what they were talking about. They didn't name it. They did not name the fact that what Willow was going through on her own and that she was really scared of what it would be reaction to was that she was in a relationship with a woman and working out her feelings of not being straight. They didn't name that. They just kind of like let it hang in a way that maybe that's, you know, maybe that doesn't need to be named now, or maybe in a realistic conversation it wouldn't need to be named, but this felt like that they were kind of like slightly trying to hide what they were talking about, so I didn't like that. And I also, like, frankly, didn't like that she thought that it was something that had to be scared of. She goes to like a liberal arts college in California. Like, I was kind of like, everyone's experience is different, whatever, but like, the fact that Buffy was validating the fact that it was something to be, like, so scared and alone about, if you know what I mean. Like, the fact that they both acted like this was a reasonable thing for Willow to felt. And I'm not, like, criticizing people for being scared. I just didn't really like... It's kind of like, remember when we had that episode where, like, no one criticized the boys being boys, like, the fish boys? Like, no one called that out within the episode. I feel like that they didn't call out enough that Willow had nothing to worry about and that they didn't name it enough and stuff like that. So yeah. I hope that makes sense, maybe.
No, that does make sense. I do think, though, that I see why you think that she should have nothing to worry about because she lives in California, but I did just remember that she... Remember, her mom is, like, super crazy.
Oh, yeah. That's...
And she comes from, like, a very conservative background, so I can see why she would have extra anxiety.
Yeah, it's true. And everyone has, you know, circumstances that are way beyond their control or, you know, reason, you know, to feel the way they do about whatever it is they feel. But there was something – it wasn't that Willow was saying it. It was that Buffy – she did say, like, oh, you can tell me anything, I love you. But it was kind of like the way that she agreed, like, oh, you were going through so much and stuff like that. There was just something about it that rubbed me up the wrong way. Like, yes, this is normal. This is what happens to gay people when they are coming out or whatever. That, you know, that kind of trauma is normal, basically. And I didn't like that. So I feel like we should be setting better examples, that the examples should be maybe better than the norm so that people know, like, so that people's minds are a little more shaped towards not being scared. But there's a lot of debate to be had there about like whether, you know, because some people all over the world do have reason to be scared. So it's difficult, but there's something about it that I didn't like. Also the fact that they were not actually using language that made it blatant what they were talking about, which felt a little soft, like they were soft peddling it. But did you like the makeup? Like, did you find it just in general cute that they made up?
I liked that they made up because I thought that there was a lot for them to talk about because they have been very separated this season. Mm-hmm. from the beginning. I don't even think it had to do with Tara. From the start, they were very separated. And I like that they were acknowledging that and that they came together. But, I mean, I hadn't thought about it that way. So I'm glad you explained it to me.
I mean, I might be totally wrong, to be honest. But
no, I think you have a right to feel the way that you feel.
Yeah, there's something about it that just vibed a little like what they were trying to normalize. I was not comfortable with the level of like, oh yeah, that is what should be normal. That is how, that is the reasonable chain of events for her to have gone through. So I don't know. Anyway, so Giles and, you know, just in case the making up of everyone, of everyone coming together to be friends again was not heavy-handed enough, they literally become one in Buffy's consciousness. So they, Xander, Willow, and Giles cast a spell because all of the different things that they need to happen, you know, only one of them has that ability. They all put their consciousness into Buffy, and she's able to defeat the demons, kill Adam, I don't know, whatever it was she was doing.
Who in here wrote that she became an avatar? Mitch, she became avatar slave.
Yeah, so the question here is basically, you know, this is obviously an extremely heavy-handed version of like, oh, we're so much better together, we're stronger together, look at how much better we are when we're not apart, when we all work together, literally. However, what Mitch has written has, why not just do this for every bad scenario, like literally go into that Slayer avatar state and bam, baddie vanquished. So, like, is this kind of like an easy out? Like, should, you know that they know they can do this, is there a reason that they can't do this every single time they have a problem?
Yes, because if someone is out fighting and they're all sitting there chanting and a giant werewolf comes in to eat them, no one is going to be able to stop it. And that's why you have to have Spike.
Okay. They basically need a panic room.
Yeah.
In which Willow and Xander and Giles just hang out. And then Buffy comes in and lets them out once she's vanquished the bad guys. That works.
What happens if Buffy dies with her their consciousnesses in her?
That was a question. I was like a little, I mean, Buffy clearly wasn't going to die. It's, the show's called Buffy. There's three more seasons. But I was like, I wonder what happens if she didn't come back from this, like, would they be, like, zombie versions of themselves or something? Like, would they just not have their actual personalities anymore or something? Like, it would be weird.
So, all in all, did you like the Xander, Buffy, Willow, Giles combo deal? Like, did you like that as a solution, as a plot point, as a beautiful moment of friendship?
I feel like it was just a way to get them off screen and give Buffy really cool contact lenses.
That battle scene is huge, and it used quite a lot of cinematic techniques that this show doesn't usually use. I feel like it must have been quite expensive because they spent a lot of time, like, focusing on a lot of those shots and like slow mo shots and like a lot of the explosions. Buffy doesn't usually do that many explosions. It's, you know, because they're the kind of stunts you can only run like once or twice, and they're very expensive. And they focused on it. They really let the camera drag on those fight scenes. So I feel like they were like, look at what we did.
I also feel like it felt very long for an action sequence Buffy from what we've seen in the past. So I don't know if that was just to like take our minds off of what was actually happening and be like, oh, right, we're totally supposed to just be rooting for Buffy this whole time. Go, Buffy, go, Buffy. But I was like, oh my gosh, this fight is taking forever. Like, it was cool, but I feel like it could have been a minute and a half shorter, maybe even less.
Yeah, and then it's like, ooh, and watch these initiative guys get killed while Spike tries to save his own skin. In the midst of all of it, like, woohoo, like that part. I mean, Buffy's fight was fine, but the general fighting outside of it, I was like, really? We need all of this? Like, they gave us a lot of that footage, and I was like, okay.
They paid for it. I want you to see it. It's a pretty common technique, but yeah, it's kind of weird for this. That being said, the Buffy quadruple deal, it wasn't really, you know, it was something more than the sum of them. It was not just, Willow's taken over now and she's doing the spell, and Giles has taken over now and he's doing the reading, if you know what I mean. Like, it wasn't like, oh, funny, they're all her inside of her, and like, oh, I'm Xander now, oh, I'm Willow now. It was a spell that made something bigger than them, happen in Buffy? Any theories about what was going on there?
Well, I'm sure they probably did something and opened some crack in the Hellmouth by doing that, and that's going to set up the next season.
It reminded me of the powers that be from Angel.
I like that.
Speaking of Angel, can't wait to talk about this Angel episode. The thing that I found very interesting about the Yoko factor, which was probably discussed last week, to be honest, but in seeing as this is a tie into this, was the tone of when we talked about the episode of Angel when, you know, she came to LA and it was very much painting her in a bad light. And then the Yoko factor very much painted Angel in a bad light. And that, you know, Buffy is as an innocent victim of horrible boy behavior and stuff like that. Just found that tone shift interesting between the two shows. And the difference is just so gaping to me now between Buffy and Angel, every episode, of who you're meant to root for, of like the perspective of the camera, of the perspective of the writing. And it is actually quite clever. Like, it's actually been quite well done in terms of, it's not just we're watching a story about Angel or Buffy, we're watching a story through their worldview and through Angel's worldview, where characters actually appear much differently through the eyes of the worldview of that show to the other. And that's actually quite interesting to do with two shows in the same universe. So I have actually been enjoying that. I just happen to enjoy the Angel worldview a bit more. But that world has a lot of more things that we know about, like the powers that be, like Wolfram and Hart, like all the things we're going to talk about, like, you know, demon brothels and fighting rings and all of those things. Buffy's world outside of the, you know, this discovery of the initiative, you know, the things that they know about in Buffy, even the things Giles knows about, seem so naive in comparison to the things that they know about in LA, you know. So I don't know how to kind of rationalize that, why they don't really get together and be like, hey, here's all the things we know about, you know, how about we broaden the scope of what we know how to fight.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, because one of the things we've been saying that we really like about Angel is the fact that when they are faced with a demon, the first question is, are they good or are they bad? It's not, oh, they're bad. And I feel like the human interactions we've seen in Buffy are all, oh, they're instantly bad. And then to go and integrate a plot line, sort of like you would see on Angel, where humans are very much aware of the underground, like, demon world, and they, like you said, they have the brothels and the fight clubs and all of this other stuff, and they're very kind of accepting of this otherness. Yeah. Not like, yeah, they exploit them and there are a lot of bad things going on, but the fact that they go about their daily lives knowing that this exists is something in and of itself. Whereas with Buffy, the people who do know it drive it underground, literally, in with the Institute. And we only see this one, at the end of this episode, we see this one backroom conversation. It's sort of like there's something going on, but it's all done behind closed doors. And that's that. Like, we don't touch it and we never talk about it in the broad daylight. Everything is done 10 miles underground, or it's done in some tiny government office so far removed that no one's going to talk about it. Whereas here, it's like Angel literally went up to, or Wesley went up to someone on the street who was knowingly going to like a demon fight club and was like, I'm the police and I'm here to take your tickets. Like, you know, like they are talking about it on the streets. Whereas here, it's very much like, we can't let anyone see what's going on, even though in Sunnydale, they kind of do, but they don't acknowledge it. They're like, oh, so many gas leaks in this high school.
Yeah, it's really odd, the difference. Like, while we're literally watching episode by episode, and maybe it's like the difference in culture between a small town and a city. There's a lot of different elements that can contribute to it. But yeah, the initiative is obviously the biggest aspect of that human world and coming into this one. So it's just a bit odd the way it was all handled. So Buffy wins. Yay. She rips Adam's heart out of his chest or something, some sort of needed, I don't know if he has a real heart, but he has something. And that's all very gross. So he's gone now. But Riley had his own little fun little plot where they were trying to make him one of the, I don't know, they were trying to make him something. I don't know if they were trying to make him one of the zombies or if they were trying to make him more like Adam. What happened more with, like, Riley?
I think they more were trying like to make him like Adam and Forrest. Like, they were going to turn him into one of them. Because the others were mindless and were useless, according to Adam.
Yeah. And then Forrest is dead, and he's a weird half-demon guy. R.I.P.
This
Forrest.
This was the first episode where I was really, like the other ones, I was like, because we were joking, like, oh, he's in love with Riley. But with this one, I was like, no, he's, like, really in love with Riley. Like, that there's definitely innuendo to suggest that, because...
Well, again, the queer coding in this show... For the 90s, or the late, very late 90s, it's still not great. Like, it's, right from the start, we were kind of like, he definitely has that kind of sassy gay friend attitude, like, you know, which, as we've stated before, in the 90s, apparently everyone had to have a sassy black friend token. And there's definitely an element of campness to it, or what we'd read as that now. But he also then had a lot of innuendo. It's like, oh, just because he had that, you know, lots of cracks about women as well. So, I mean, it's just interestingly, when I say interestingly done, it felt like the traditional 90s queer subtext, which is not really something I think is a positive thing, but... We're here now, I guess. But yeah, what in particular made you feel like he was in love with Riley?
When their, like, final showdown, when he's like, this is all Buffy's fault. Like, he's like, she tore us apart and, like,
oh, God, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
I was like, wow, this is definitely, like, scorned lover.
Yeah, what else happened? Basically, big, big fight inside the initiative. Yay, everyone fought. Buffy won. Riley survived after cutting out the chip out of his own chest, which was disgusting. Good for him, I guess. He pulled through. And then, yeah, as Brittany mentioned, that we got that backroom conversation between the, you know, the commanding officer and the government employee about, you know, Maggie Walsh's experiment. She had a vision, it failed. We're going to disband the initiative project. We're going to fill up the hole with concrete. So that's it, I guess. Like, everything's going to, you know, they're not going to mess around with demons anymore. Imagine that the government, not that Maggie's project was the greatest way of handling it, if you know what I mean, because she, all of those, you know, experimenting, the kind of, you know, the way that they treated the soldiers, everything about it was pretty corrupt. But imagine the government knowing about, like, monsters, like demons and monsters and all of that kind of thing. The government aware of it, trying to do something about it, and then being like, nah, we'll just let them keep doing their demon and monster thing. Like, you know, like, it's completely bizarre, but I guess that's what's happened.
I think I remember them saying, like, this project has failed. We have others, you know.
Oh, we'll, I just suppose move on. That's true.
Like, when they did that voiceover weirdo wrap it up thing, it was, I think he talked about, like, this project has failed. We'll move on to the next. Like, we've got other places where this is necessary.
That's fair enough, probably, that they were, that they're trying all these different things. But, yeah, the fact that the government have not reached out to Buffy either to capture her or to force her into being, like, a public servant or something like that, it's kind of weird. But, yeah, that closing conversation, I think, is another example of just the weirdness of this entire plot line and how it could have been more. Was any of it interesting to you guys? Like, is there anything there that you're like, oh, that's so messed up or so, you know, interesting in some way?
I just keep thinking, I want to know what their intentions were by taking the invisible children. I just want to know what that program
back in
is.
Because
anytime the government is involved, I'm like, okay, but where are the invisible people and what are they doing?
They were being trained by the FBI, I believe, as, like,
assassins.
Wet work. Yeah, assassins, I believe.
I know, but I just, I want to see them in action, not the initiative.
You want to spin off about that. Yeah. So, initiative's disbanded. Riley has survived. He deserted the initiative. Mitch has asked, wait, won't he die next week then? White bread like that is bound to go stale eventually. Wow. I don't know. You tell me. Is Riley going to die next week?
If Angel comes back and kills him, maybe.
Oh, that would be so good.
I loved that Riley thought that he was evil, like that was Angelus. Oh, it was so good. aside from the potential.
I mean, the only other way I can think he'd die is if Spike, like, takes him out.
But then,
like,
that would turn everybody against Spike.
No, yeah. We like Spike. He's shiny star of season
but
4.
But, like, it you know, we have no idea what happens in the next episode because everything's wrapped up here. So it's like, how could he die? I mean, I'm who knows? It's Buffy. Be anything.
Yeah, speaking of Spike, obviously over the last few episodes, he's had his plot, which is that he went and helped out Adam in order to try and get the chip removed from him, the chip that made him unable to hurt humans, and, you know, was sort of playing the Slayerettes with the Yoko Factor, which happened last week. Even in this episode, he was pretending that he was still, you know, getting information for them, and then he was really meeting with Adam and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know. What do you guys predict for Spike in the next little while? Like, they didn't kill him, as I said. Like, they do you think that this would have been grounds to kill him? Like, you know, or are they kind of, do you think they're kind of treating him with human rules, given that he can't hurt humans? Like, that they wouldn't just kill another human for doing this. You know, they would leave it up to, I don't know, someone else. The fact that they refused to execute Spike is still interesting to me, basically. And I'm just curious if anyone has any further thoughts on that and whether he deserves it. Obviously, we don't want it to happen. Or whether, you know, it would make the show look bad if they did such a thing.
I don't think he needs to die because, I mean, all he wanted was to get that chip out of his head. But I feel like at this point in the show, I don't necessarily think that once he got it out, he would be running to kill Buffy or any of them. I think that he would start to have second thoughts. And so I think they've really played well in his, like, morally gray area this season in the little bits that they gave him, like, you know, where he's tied up in Giles's place for a few episodes and he's working for them, but he always has his eye on another way out. He's selfish. He's going to be looking out for himself. And I don't think that it's necessarily grounds for killing him. Buffy's looking out for herself all the time and we're not killing her. So why go after Spike?
I don't know, just because they as we've talked about on Buffy, they don't have as much of a sense of personhood between, you know, anyone who's not human as opposed to Angel. So the fact, but they really don't have any of the good guys in this show just choose to kill in cold blood, which,
yeah,
I think is, I get it, but I also think it's, and I don't want Spike to die, but I feel like that the show would be more interesting if they were willing to just, like, quietly go in and kill someone who needed to be killed in cold blood. It's something other shows do, and it makes the characters, I think, a little deeper. And I feel like this is a little cartoony for them to, like, we know this guy in Buffy's world, in Buffy's view, deserves to die, and we know that she would kill him if she could. However, we don't, you know, he won't do it, like she won't do it, you know, or we won't see it on screen as, right, you're going to stand there and we're going to cut your head off like it's a Henry VIII execution style situation.
I don't even really feel, though, that they're doing it just to be, like, good people. I kind of feel like they like him, like they hate that they like him, but I think that they do kind of enjoy him.
He's one of us now. We hate him, but he's one of us. Maybe. I don't know. Is there anything else in particular you wanted to talk about with this episode? Any questions? Like, anything you think wasn't wrapped up?
No, let's move on.
Okay, let's move on. Favorite scenes, favorite lines, and then we get to Angel. So my favorite scene of the episode was probably the bit where Giles opens the door in his velveteen robe and is hungover from his events of the night before, which I just found hysterically funny. Just when he's just like, will you be working? Will you be talking or typing here or anything like that? And I just found him fantastic. I really hope that he has a good time soon because he seems to really be losing the plot. Like, how many of you were on last week?
I was.
And me.
Did any of you, please tell me that one of you picked your favourite quote was, "Ah, no, sir, I'm not like Alfred. Alfred had a job." Please tell me that was someone's favourite quote because it's magical. But I feel like Giles is really, really losing the plot. And obviously everyone in this episode got their sense of purpose back altogether. So any theories about what Giles will be like from here on out now that he's not a drunk?
He still doesn't have a purpose, though, does he? Like, he's still at ground zero.
He needs a job.
He needs a job.
Poor Giles. Maybe if he can't work at the library, he should, like, open up a bookshop.
Yeah.
Or
go work at that magical
coffee
place.
House. Oh, my gosh. Like, on Friends. That would give them all a place to go.
He could sing to them.
Yeah. Yes. He could sing open mic night. It can have a used bookstore element to it, too. So they have, like, a back room to go talk about things in. It could work.
Yes. We just Dreams. Saved the show.
Ariana, what was your favorite moment of this episode?
Mine was when they were all, like, trying to save the world and they didn't take things into consideration, like locking the door. And Spike saved them all, and so then they couldn't kill him. But they were just like, oh, whatever. But he, like, saved them, like, in quotation marks, saved. I kind of, when I watched it, I was like, I bet he, like, threw that thing in there so that then he could.
Oh, yeah.
Look like the good guy.
Yeah. And he was like, hey, follow me. I know a way out. And then he was like, okay, now I'm going to beat you to death.
Why do you think he wants to look good to them?
Because he doesn't want to die. Chip in his head. He can't defend himself.
But also, he secretly likes them too.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he wants to be a part of the group.
I think he's secretly freaking obsessed with them. He doesn't have any other friends, and he likes company. He likes being a person. He likes having someone to talk about television with. Like, I think that he really wants to hang out.
He doesn't like that they don't like him. I think he enjoys that.
Mm-hmm. Brittany, how about you?
I liked, right after the part that you hated, Natalie, I liked when Xander finally, like, propels down the wall and he sees Willow and Buffy hugging, and then they're hugging him, and he instantly goes to the worst case scenario. He's just like, oh, well, this means we're all gonna die, right? Because we wouldn't be this mushy around each other if we weren't going to face immediate death.
You know what I liked about that scene, Natalie? That it had nothing to do with Willow. I wasn't paying attention to her. The only thing I liked about it is that Buffy was like, no, you're right. I have been spending all my time with Riley. Because I was like, yeah, lady, she's been so obsessed with Riley. She's totally left everybody. So,
yeah.
And I hate Riley. So I liked that she for once admitted some fault. And it wasn't like a backhanded fault like she did with Angel. Where she's like, no, you're right. We do lead separate lives.
Yeah, I think that one thing with season four, you know, for better or worse, they were quite realistic in like, oh, we've gone to college, everything's changed, and then they kind of didn't realize like how much things had changed or like how their priorities had changed, and then acknowledging that. So I kind of liked that. This was kind of, I guess, a nice moment for that. But yeah. And then Kristen, how about you?
Mine's the scene where Buffy starts asking Willow and Xander, like, who told you that we were talking about you? And they all kind of realize all at once that Spike was the one who had been, you know, working them all against each other. And I just love how, like, Giles gets kind of sheepish about it. And, like, they're all just kind of like, yeah, he did, didn't he? And it's just a cute little moment.
Yeah, I found that quite hysterical as well, and I assume we have one of the quotes about it there. So moving on to the favorite lines of Buffy this episode, Primeval. My favorite quote from the episode was actually, well, I really liked Giles being like, Xander, just because this is never going to work, there's no need to be negative, which I found. The two quotes that I picked are actually a very good dichotomy of like my personality for most of my life versus my personality or what I'm aiming to be more towards now. Because the original quote that I picked was actually Anya to Xander being like, you still upset about that fight you had with your friends? It was hours ago. Get over it. And I picked this because this attitude is so unbelievably me that I really don't generally hold grudges to start with. Like, I really don't. And a lot of stuff that people have been like, oh, this happened. And yeah. And I'm like, I literally don't even remember that. So sorry. And that's not that great, but it's been pretty true to my life. But the bluntness of it and the kind of not even just I don't hold grudges, but the whole like, why would you care about that is definitely how I rolled through life for a good like 25 to 27 years. And then like since then, I've kind of been more like a few years ago had a real active change to try and not be negative about things or try and be less terrible. And so Giles's quote is more representative of that, though I am still pretty blunt about things when they're going to fail. So not quite accurate, but I enjoyed both of those. So that's me. Ariana, what was your favorite quote of the episode?
Mine was when they were talking about the demon guy Adam's plan, and Xander goes, does anybody else miss the mayor? I just want to be a big snake, because I agreed with him. I do miss the mayor. This season has made me miss the mayor. So
it's interesting that they call out how convoluted they've been and like, oh, does anyone miss that time when we weren't convoluted? So Brittany.
Mine was also the mayor line, but my second favorite was Willow or Buffy. So I think it was Buffy said when they were talking about how to like separate Adam from his life source. And she was like, what about magic? Isn't there some uranium summoning spell? And I was like, yeah, it's called Accio, but you're not cool enough to exist in that universe. So you can't have it.
Kristen, what was yours?
Mine comes from Xander, and it's right after they like found out that Spike was, you know, double crossing them. And he goes, Spike's working for Adam? After all we've done for... No, I can't even act surprised.
It was, yes, a highlight of the episode, that quote, yeah, for sure. Angel, episode 121 is Blind Date. So moving on from Buffy, swiftly. In this episode, a blind assassin is set to kill seer children, bringing lawyer Lindsay briefly over to the light side. Angel is really peeved at the blind assassin and takes it upon himself to kill her, but apparently child murder wasn't good enough to keep Lindsay wanting to be good. The lawyer takes a new role as owner of the world, which surely can't be a good thing. Okay, so first question I'm going to ask, obviously, is did anyone else get Daredevil vibes from this blind assassin woman? I don't think that question even needs to be asked. I think that it is a very obvious metaphor, a very obvious parallel to draw there. Daredevil was not necessarily in the public consciousness at much at this very moment. I can't remember what year the Ben Affleck movie was, but yes, it's very Daredevil. So question answered. Do you guys watch Daredevil? Kristen, maybe?
Yes. Yeah, yes. I've watched Daredevil twice, actually, because I watched it with Karen the second, both times, actually, now that I think about it. It's all her fault, but yeah, no, you definitely get some Daredevil vibes from this episode.
The guys who are making this, like Joss, obviously, but also David Greenwald, like the other EP, who Joss doesn't have as much control over Angel as you might, as like people like, oh, Joss Whedon. It's a Joss Whedon universe show. He did not have that much control in Angel. Like, yes, it was still his concept, but he didn't write that many episodes, and he wasn't sitting in the room for that many episodes, apparently. And there was a joint EP and stuff like that. The director of this episode is actually a director I really like from a lot of other television, including some really, really good Supernatural, called Thomas J. Wright. So he's a pretty famous television director, so that was a little thing that I enjoyed about this. But what I was saying, yeah, everyone involved in this, like there are quite a few Marvel references we've had before, like Captain America reference, that at the time this was airing, they were pretty obscure Marvel references, which Joss and his team, always big Marvel fans, you know, Joss got to do the work with Marvel because he was a very, you know, lifelong fan of you know, the comics when they weren't necessarily getting movies made out of them and stuff like that. So moving on from Daredevil, that's an obvious thing that happened. Lindsay is a massive part of this episode. How does everyone currently feel about Lindsay after this episode or throughout this episode, anything like that? So Lindsay obviously has his arc of, you know, he's defending the blind woman, gets away with it. We learn more about like the fact that this is just a job that he fell into, was able to become successful in, you know, an opportunity to become successful, gets to the point where he's being asked to make up a cover story to cover up, like, you know, the murder of a bunch of children, or at least a defense for the murder of a bunch of children. And at this point he's like, nope, I'm gone, Angel, let's go and stop this. So ultimately by the end of the episode, he kind of feels like, you know, he can use the success being offered to him by Wolfram and Hart, or who knows what his plans are, but we get the impression that, you know, he's taking the offer given to him by his old boss to basically not, you know, not go over to Angel and not get out of the line of business. So anyone got any strong thoughts on Lindsay's arc throughout this episode, or you know, what where you thought it was going to go? Like, did it surprise you, the ending? Did it surprise you that he even got soft in the middle? Like, how do we feel? Ariana, any thoughts on him?
I was kind of bummed, to be honest, because for a hot minute there I was like, oh my gosh, is he gonna come over to Angel's team? Because I was a big fan of Leverage. Did anybody see Leverage?
Yeah,
and he's on Leverage, and yeah, that's I kind of feel like he's playing like the same character here, like the same personality type. And I was like, oh, he's going to come on Angel's show. It'll be just like at Leverage. We've got like the nerdy guy, Wesley, and we've got like the weird girl, Cordelia. And I was like, oh, this is perfect.
Christian Kane this is Lindsay, Christian Kane. In Leverage, I believe he was hired because I actually saw a panel with him earlier this year and actually also did a little interview with him, which again, I've been waiting to publish because it was really spoilery that he was any part of the show aside from the first episode. And now we obviously know that he's an ongoing character. So again, once season four ends, once season one of Angel ends, you're going to get those interviews up on Hyperball, Christian Kane and James Masters. Sorry, I've been promising them for ages, but I really feel worried about them. So he, I believe on Leverage, was hired as the fight coordinator because he's like a professional combatant. If you know, like his role is, you know, and his role on Leverage was almost incidental to the fact that he was the fight choreographer. And so he probably did draw a lot of that role from other characters that he played. And then it grew into something much more of its own thing with Leverage. Anyway, anyone else got any thoughts about Lindsay himself? Like, did you guys want him to be good? Do you like that he stayed bad? Is he a secret mole in Wolfram and Hart, like playing both sides? Like, any theories about him so far, Brittany or Kristen?
I liked that it was a little open-ended because, you know, all he's doing is, like, you know, sitting on top of the world, basically. He's given this position of power, and his guardian, or the anyone who would have been really above him within that office, sort of just walks away and leaves him to his own devices, but is sort of in his mind being like, well, if you come to accept, like, you know, the love that is here for you and for this position and what we're doing, and, you know, you really give yourself over to the work, you'll be rewarded. And he's getting a taste of that. But I like that it's sort of like in this gray area, sort of with Spike. Like, Spike's not saying, yes, I'm completely good, or yes, I'm completely bad. We're sort of going one week to another, not really knowing what he's doing. And I like that we have that sort of character here because it's going to push the story, some of these stories along, and it's something we can always come back to.
Yeah, like, I never thought we'd get any of these people at Wolfram and Hart. Like, I never thought we'd see them as people. Like, they're these corporate lawyer drones who do what they're told and they're evil. I really thought that's just all they were going to be. So I was a little surprised in this episode to find out that one of them does have a conscience and, you know, does kind of draw the line here. And I'm with Brittany. I do like that it's left open-ended and that hopefully somewhere down the line, like, maybe he'll see the light again and be like, I can't be behind this. Like, this is not okay. And yeah, will eventually come back to the light. Like, he's been tempted with something he's never had in his life, which is security, and I can kind of understand that. You know, it's tough, but I never had any strong feelings about Lindsay before this episode, but now I'm kind of like, okay, all right, you know, maybe you're a real person. He's a real boy.
What really struck out to me, actually, in this episode was the girl who kept talking.
Lila.
Yes. That girl. Yeah. There was, because when you were saying, like, is he a double agent? I feel more like she might be a double agent because she was definitely, I don't know, there was just something, like, when he went down to meet her or to go get the files and then he ran into her and she was, like, shifty and then she definitely looked like, I don't know, when she pulled out that cell phone and was like, cancel the lunch. I don't know. She just seems kind of shifty to me, but since she's in a shifty place, I'm like, is she secretly good? Like, is she trying to take them down? What is going on? So I thought she was kind of interesting.
Well, good. Interesting. Lindsay is one of my most interesting characters, certainly at this period of Angel, and I do enjoy him. Wolfram and Hart is a big feature. Like, it's a big feature of the of this universe that we're currently in, like with the angel, with LA, with the demon community and stuff like that. So yeah, the lawyers there, the characters there are fleshing out the show, which I quite like. Like, I think that that's quite interesting. It's a little, as I said, like, it's a little less cartoonish than Buffy. Like, we're the good team, we're the evil team. Yes, they're Wolfram and Hart are quite evil, but it's interesting to see what we have here, especially as we're dealing with humans, not like, oh, I'm a vampire who's got like somewhat of a conscience or something like that. So are you rooting for Lindsay at this point? Like, do you want, like, are you just like, was anyone like, screw you for going back to your office? Or was anyone, you know, rooting for him or thinking he might be like, oh, I can make change from within? Or is it like pure selfishness? Any of those range of emotions about him?
I feel like he might come back.
Yeah.
What do you think, Brittany?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's going to come back and we're still going to have to figure out who he is. And he has to figure out who he is, first of all. So we are sort of in the same spot as Lindsay, where we want him to either be an informant or be completely bad, or what do we want from him? And he's also sitting there thinking, okay, do I go with the familiarity and stability and power, or do I use the familiarity, stability, and power to fight for what I know is right and the people who are trying to make things better outside?
How did you feel about him and Angel's relationship? Like the way that they spoke to each other, the chemistry. I mean, Brittany, you had this as your favorite scene, so we'll get to that in a bit. But just in general, because I just wanted to fill you guys in on another little aspect of them, which is that it's not why he got the job, but Angel, at the time, Christian and David, so Christian Kane and David Boreanaz were best friends in real life. So they're incredibly, incredibly close friends, and Christian again did like quite a bit of the fight training on Angel at points as well, like behind the scenes. So I was just wondering if how you felt about like watching them on screen. Did you have any particular feeling towards their dynamic in this episode at all?
Well, now that you said that, you can really see that in that scene, and that's probably why I was really tuned in into that moment, is because that chemistry was there. And it wasn't like not knowing that. It's interesting now to think that, oh, I really felt like I was in that scene and it was a really good conversation. And the two actors were just like really in sync with each other. Not that they're like, you know, Angel and Cordelia, like they're in sync with each other, but they've had that long, we've seen them work together over, like, you know, through Buffy and then here, and we've seen them work to the level of comfort that they are at now, whereas this just felt really natural.
Yeah, I agree, because that scene, when they're talking in Angel's office, that the scenes when they're talking together, I think it stood out as some of the most natural on-screen chemistry the Buffy universe has had so far. So I just wanted to see if anyone else felt that or if that's just me.
I have a quick question. So was he... So Christian Kane is like a stunt guy?
He's a lot of things. He's an actor, singer, stunt man type thing. But yeah, so he's done a lot of, he's not a stunt guy, but yes, for some reason he has enough fight training to be a fight choreographer. And he's done work on that on the shows that he's been in, basically, if you know what I mean. Like on the shows that he has been a part of, he's also done work behind the scenes with the fight stuff. I am not quite sure which came first, the chicken or the egg, but yes, it is something that he has done. So obviously he hasn't had that much fighting on this show, but in Leverage he's like the heavy. Yeah. And you may see action on this show as well, but yeah, he definitely did all his own stunts and fights on Leverage, and should he have any on this show, the same thing would apply. And he certainly worked, as the fight choreographer for the rest of the team that he was working with on Leverage and somewhat on this show as well. He's a really cool guy. He's really got a lot of opinions about his characters when he's talked about them. He's also a singer as well. Like, he sings, I believe, in Leverage, stuff like that. But just the relationship that he had with David. And interestingly, they're not close anymore. They had a falling out, and he talks about that pretty openly as well. Not like a beef, not like here's what it was about, but like he kind of isn't quiet about the fact that they had a falling out, so they don't really talk anymore. So that's also...
Interesting.
You ruined my notes too, because I was like, Christian and David are BFFs for real. Oh wait,
they're not. They're not BFFs for real anymore.
That's so sad.
He has, Yeah, he is BFFs with Jensen Ackles for real, though. So that's not relevant to our show notes, but it's true. Sorry. They were BFFs. They are not BFFs anymore, but they were very close at the time that the show was being made, yes. And not just because of the show, like before that as well. Anyway, moving on from Christian Kane, though possibly not from Lindsay. So they make this plan, which is to, you know, to infiltrate Wolfram and Hart to get the discs needed to get the information about what the, you know, what the plan was for these children that were going to be attacked. And I just wanted to see how you felt that this heist plan compared with the Buffy initiative heist plan. Did anyone, like, compare the two, compare and contrast? Like, here's our plan to infiltrate or anything like that, or feel, like, strongly about how this was done?
I think this really plays into the conversation that we were having earlier about the tone of the two shows, because Buffy's infiltration felt very dark and, like, you know, it's a one-woman show, like, even though she, you know, had the consciousness or whatever was going on there of the whole team, whereas Angels felt very strategic and almost like light. It was lighthearted, and it was, you know, Kristen mentions this in the way she wrote how it's her favorite scene, but like very Mission Impossible style. Like, you could have muted this whole scene and played the Mission Impossible music, and it would have been hilarious and still worked so well, you know?
So many elements, and that they gave you no warning of it in advance. Like, you know, we saw him recruit Gunn, so that was like, did you guys expect to see Gunn again after the last episode?
Not so soon. I mean, we definitely talked about him coming back and them leaving that door open. I wasn't expecting him to be in this episode.
And they just had all of those different pieces of the puzzle of getting into Wolfram. Like, you know, they had Lindsay, they had Angel going in the basement. They had this, you know, the setting off of the other, you know, Gunn coming in as like the crazy man who yells on the street, which I would, you know, dismiss as a stereotype, except I've been to LA and it's a true stereotype. I'll say that. There are people that yell with that level of passion and nonsensicalness all over the place, honestly. That kind of, like, playing that role, bringing in the vampire so the Angel could go in undetected, because they're like, oh, there's a vampire, oh, it's that vampire. Every piece of it was so cleverly done that I just loved it. But and then Buffy's was very, like, mystical and, like, not, you know, like, you know, very magic-based and all that. So it's just interesting that they had those kind of, like, heist reveals in both episodes that we watched this week. So what happens? They get in. They get Gunn back. Lynn, if you could pick between Lindsay or Gunn joining the team, which one would it be?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, they both have very different things to offer. Mm-hmm. Like, Lindsay has, you know, influence and legal know-how that could come in handy that they don't really have at Angel Investigations. But, like, Gunn brings just, like, passion for, you know, helping people and some street know-how, and he brings a very different set of skills to the table. So I don't know. I mean, I like Gunn better than Lindsay, so I would probably weigh higher toward asking him on.
I was gonna say, I think Lindsay is more interesting than Gunn. I think he has more layers. I feel like we've seen, like, Gunn in, or like, we get Gunn, who he is. For that reason, I would prefer Lindsay. On a, like, practical reason, I would prefer Gunn, since he's, like, literally the only person of color we've seen on this show. So I would like that. Although I do wish, I don't know, sometimes I like that they acknowledge his blackness, and sometimes I'm like, why are you playing into so many stereotypes already? It's only been two episodes.
It's so hit and miss. I love him calling out how terrible white people are all the time, but I'm like, are you doing this, like, constantly to show that, yes, you can have black people, or is this meant to be natural?
It makes me feel like I want to know who the writers are. Like, is it an all-white room? If it's an all-white room, then that makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
So you'd like to have him as a person of color, but as a character, as the actual character writing, you prefer Lindsay at the moment?
Yeah, yes? Well, because I feel like if Gunn joined the team, I would be like, yeah, Gunn is great. But if, like, Lindsay joined the team, we would always be like, but is he going to leave? Is he going to, like, turn his back on them? When is he going to betray them? So That would
have so Lindsay That's... equals Spike.
Yeah.
Well, this episode was written by a woman, Janine Renshaw. I don't know who she is. I mean, let's not front. The room was probably pretty white, but she is a producer of many other shows, including Charmed, Grey's Anatomy, Red Band Society. She's worked with Shonda Rhimes a fair bit. Anyway, that is not that relevant. We haven't really been tracking writers on this show. It's weird. Other shows that I watched, like when I covered Glee and now with Supernatural as well, I'm like, oh, who wrote what episode? Oh, I noticed trends in certain writers' episodes. I have never, ever tracked like trends in the different Buffy writers' episodes or Angel writers' episodes. So I'm curious if there's anyone out there that does, if there's anyone that's got particular favorite writers for Buffy or Angel, and or tropes in particular writers' episodes. That's something that's actually generally very interesting to me, but I have not actually done anything with in terms of this show. So Lindsay, Gunn, Wolfram and Harp, they have all of these booby traps, basically. They have a vampire detecting demon. They have mind readers. They have all sorts of things. Mitch in the dock would like to know how Angel got past their threshold without setting off any alarms the other time. Was he not brought there? Has he not gone there with permission on other times? Or is it like, oh, Angel, you know, vampire, and they're like, oh, he's with someone. He's here for a reason. Or has he broken into Wolfram and Harp before?
Well, I think he was talking about the fact that, like, the vampire, like, when the vampire was on the premises, that a demon could sense it. So if Angel had been on the premises before, that demon that senses vampires should have been.
He has been before, at least two times.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. I think possibly maybe he did set that off, but he just wasn't there long enough for it to matter. Like, and he's never spent a ton of time in Wolfram and Harp. He's been in and out.
What the he's been there before, times he was there invited, were they like, oh, he's taking a meeting, or Lila brought him here, or did he break in before?
The first time he threw someone out a window.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. It could be that, like, oh, we're letting him do, you know, we're getting the measure of him, if you know what I mean. I feel like that one thing that they hammered home, like Lindsay's boss hammered home, is that they know way more than we think they know, so they have probably been totally aware of Angel's actions and just letting them play out because they want to see how they can use him or whatever and get the measure of him because they don't really care about the collateral damage.
Wasn't there like alarms that went off when the vampire got out last time? Don't you remember, like in this episode, wasn't there like vampire and like sirens?
Well, there was in the security room, and it's possible that last time the Angel came on, there was, you know, in the security room, they were like, oh, vampire. And he, you know, and then someone called it down being like, no, we're watching this guy. It's fine. If you know what I mean.
Or maybe
I don't know.
They added an extra layer of vampire security after he broke in and threw someone out a window.
That's also very, very valid. Agreed. After the break-in, they, you know, they pull in all of the staff at Wolfram and Harp to get, you know, checked who was responsible or if, you know, that anything with an inside job. And this is where Lindsay, you know, obviously suspects that he's going to get caught. His, you know, annoying friend Lee gets caught, you know, talking about moving to another law firm and gets shot in the head by the security guard. So that's pleasant and fun. And I don't know if that means there's more than one lawyer that has all of this supernatural stuff going on, or if they defend regular clients as well as Supernatural. We learn there that obviously that kind of like small mutiny is like, we don't care, you're an idiot, but you've done something that sucks for us, so we're going to kill you. Whereas Lindsay, they knew perfectly well about the betrayal, but were happy to let it play out and see how clever he could be, how much he could do, and then twist that around to their benefit. So that's, you know, it's pretty smart, I guess, but it's pretty gross. And one of my biggest things that I hate with villains is like, the whole, like, aspect of a gross higher power, like, watching someone, you know, watching someone perform unknowingly. Like, what, you know, oh, we love him. We love how, you know, what he's doing. Kind of, like, think, like, you know, Emperor Palpatine and him, like, kind of being like, oh, yes, awesome, at Luke and Darth Vader, like, fighting with each other, kind of, like, enjoying the fruits of his evil labor. And I feel like that about these guys, like, with Wolfram and Harp, like, the way that they're treating Lindsay. That they are enjoying watching how smart he is and rewarding that ultimately if he gives them their loyalty, even if what he was being smart about was betraying them. And that's how we kind of get to the end point of the episode of him in that office. And if you want to leave, walk out the door, and he walks over to the door and then he doesn't leave. He closes it behind him. And I don't know, it's all very dramatic, but yeah, it's where we're at. So does this now mean he is in charge? Is he, going to be the actual one in charge of everything in Wolfram and Heart, or at least everything on the level that we've seen so far? And what does this mean? Like, what do you suspect about Wolfram and Heart and their long-term presence on the show? Like, it's a big bad.
I can definitely see Wolfram and Heart, like, kind of lingering as this, not necessarily like all-out evil presence all the time, but them continuing to be a thorn in Angel's side, like as he continues to go on and deal with different demons throughout the city and all of that. Like, I can see him continuously coming up against Wolfram and Heart until eventually there's a big clash where one cannot, they cannot both exist in the same place anymore. But for now, like, I definitely see it being kind of the long con, like the both of them are going to be coming up against each other for a while before this hits a head and finally just explodes. As far as like his role, as far as Lindsay's role in it and like what he's in charge of now, I kind of just assumed he was filling Lee's spot and that Lee was more of like a trusted adversary when it comes to everything. So I figured him like literally sitting in Lee's office at Lee's desk meant that he was kind of filling his role, but I don't know.
I'm not sure, but I mean, do you guys feel like there is any chance that they could wrap up Wolfram and Heart in the next finale, like in the finale next week?
No, absolutely not.
There's too much going on.
That would probably be an accurate guess.
That would be kind of cool if they carried over as villains, because on Buffy we haven't really had that. I mean, we like kind of had that with Faith, but it wasn't, I don't know.
So would you consider having the opposite of Buffy, as we spoke about with this week with Buffy, is the first time that they've not had like an open season, closed season, the monster big bad is gone, and then next year it's a clean slate. Would you, if Angel could be the potential for the opposite, to have one story being told over five seasons with this, like, a, you know, that we're only seeing a very small piece of the same story. Like, you know, I'm not saying that it is that, not saying, you know, that it's not that, there could be a happy medium somewhere, but if it was the extreme opposite of Buffy, that it was literally one story over five seasons, not just the same character, you know, characters going up against different things each season, but this whole powers that be, Wolfram and Heart situation being a long-term five-year story, would you like that? Would you hate that? Would you prefer it to the Buffy format? What's your favorite preference here?
Well, I think that they would, well, first of all, I do like it better when it's like that, because I feel like then you have more time to get invested and so you care more. But I think that they have a good opportunity to do that here, because it isn't as clean cut as it usually is with Buffy. Like, there's nobody turning into a giant snake. It's just bad people and complicated people. And I mean, like, Lindsay, is he bad? I don't know. He's like complicated. So I think it presents more of an arc that people can go through.
Yeah. And since we're watching both shows, it would get kind of boring and old if they both had the same format. Like, if they both were doing the same thing, why is Angel on his own show? I like that Angel seems to have like a bigger story to tell. Something bigger is on the horizon for him, as opposed to Buffy, who's more in the now. She's the immediate future, and how do I solve this next problem?
And of course, that leads us to the whole scroll thing, the prophecy, the scroll, whatever's going on there that they steal and translate. Angel, you know, sets off another alarm. Like, that's when the alarm actually goes off in the building, by the way. It's, you know, they have the demon alert vampire guy, but the audio alarms start happening when Angel takes that scroll off its holder. So that is what actually set off the panic in the building. And he, for some reason, Angel, you know, has his little dreamy, oh, I'm going to take that as well. And then they take it home and start translating it. And turns out there's a bit about him. So he was mystically drawn to get this scroll. Beast's prophecy. Any theories at all what the hell was going on there?
I was so mad at him at the time. I was like, you dumb idiot. Like, it's just like the Aladdin thing. I, like, can't with that scene every time.
With what in Aladdin?
In Aladdin, when he, like, they're like, don't touch anything. And you're like, you had one job. Don't touch anything. And then he has to touch something.
It's just so uncharacteristic for Angel as well to do something like that.
Yeah.
And so
I don't know. I guess it was probably the powers that be guiding him to it. So
yeah, now that we've got the prophecy or the scroll from Wolfmanheart, we've got Lindsay in position as, like, still skeptical. Like, you know, he doesn't go in there wanting his job back. He goes in there being like, here's the discs back. I kept enough information to protect myself from you. I just want to leave. Got, you know, Cordy and Wesley, who are kind of just adorably there in this episode. They're not really, like, a big part of what goes down, but they're there. And we've got Angel choosing to bring Gunn back in as well, as someone who he feels is equipped to fight at that level. So, again, this is a pretty big episode. Next week is the finale. Any theories at all about where it might go from here?
I feel like it's going to do the same thing that Buffy's going to do, where something's going to happen and it's going to set up the next season. So maybe there'll be some sort of threat that's unrelated to Wolfmanheart, and then they can get involved as the next season unfolds in some way, shape, or form. But I'm not really sure. I'm kind of liking not knowing where Angel and Buffy are heading into their finales, because I feel like it would be easy for Buffy to just, you know, drag this Adam thing out until the season finale, and it could have been easy for Angel too to turn this episode into a two-parter. And
yeah,
I kind of like just not knowing anything, and I didn't see the Netflix descriptions.
Yeah, maybe since we know so little about both of them, maybe it'll be like a crossover. Like, that would be like, I get so angry every time Buffy goes on Angel and Angel goes on Buffy, because they infuriate me. But I would kind of love, like, a flat, like, you know how Flash and Arrow do their superhero crossover. Like, I would really love to see Cordelia and Wesley, like, new Cordelia and new Wesley, who, like, know that Angel's got their back and have a newfound confidence. Like, I'd kind of like to see them waltz into Sunnydale again.
I really wish that we get to see, like, Buffy, Willow, all of them reacting to Cordy and Angel's relationship in the way that it sits now. Like, because in the past crossovers, you know, like, with Angel going to Sunnydale and being all douchey and, like, you know, all of that, and then you have him come back the next episode in, and, you know, his episode after he went back to Sunnydale, and get trapped in the meat locker and is all like, I get to decide when we use the phones. And, like, it's just such a different, like, I wish that all of those guys could be a fly on the wall to Angel Investigations, just so they could, like, get a real perspective of who Angel actually is, because I feel like none of them know him at all. And it's just, again, really interesting that the worldview of the show, you know, how it paints each person, you know, each hero, Buffy and Angel, when they're not just apart from each other, but when they're, you know, living their own stories, as about, you know, how this is how Buffy looks to Angel when it's Angel's point of view. This is how Angel looks to Buffy when it's Buffy's point of view, when they cross over into each other's shows. And it's just really interesting to see how different that is from what we know as their quote unquote real point of view, which is the one that, you know, that we get to see. So
I would just love to see how, like, shocked and offended they would all be to witness, like, how much, like, joking aside, not, like, how much he loves her if she gets in a fight with Buffy. Like, whose side is he going to pick? I bet he's probably going to pick Cordy's.
Yeah. Just as people, as personalities, like, you know, she is so sweet with him. Like, he is so sweet with both of them. He makes them pancakes. I bet he never freaking cooked for Buffy. You know, you never saw him being human with Buffy. That's the thing. They never showed anything in Buffy of, you know, it's all, oh, it's so tragic, we can't have a normal life. You can still freaking make pancakes and, like, hang out at someone's house and watch a movie. And I know that they were, like, hiding it from Joyce at some point, and then after that they weren't, but whatever. They could have had everything normal except, well, I guess sex. But surely, like, you'd get over it after the first time. Surely it's not every single time you have sex. It would just be like,
on Pushing Daisies, they found ways to get creative.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like they could have had so much normalcy as people. You know, they could have been in love. They could have been best friends. They could have been whatever. It's just, and they could have done normal things. Like they once went to a movie and it had too much French sex in it and they couldn't handle it. It's like, no, where are Buffy's pancakes? Like, why were they never normal with each other?
Yeah, and like,
where are Buffy's pancakes?
There was my favorite scene last week was when Angel and Buffy are together in the hallway and Angel like cracks a joke and Buffy laughs. So I was like, that is the Angel that we finally got to on Angel. And he was there on Buffy. Like it felt so nice to just see that.
And the same scene moment right before when Riley's like, I'm not leaving this room. And they both just look at each other and are like, okay. And walk out of the room together. Like, it's so clever. And it's so much more like, oh, these are two people that really know each other really well and are being human with each other, which has never happened before when they were actually going out. So like, what were they waiting for? Like, what did they not really know? Like, it's not like they didn't know that Angel was like this derpy nerd before then, because he was like that in Buffy as well, just not usually in front of her. It was usually around everyone except her, so he was trying really hard to be cool or something. Anyway,
my dreams
yeah.
For everyone to be jealous of Cordy.
Of Angel and Cordy. So that happened. Some blind seer children were there. They got saved.
Yeah, we should probably Lindsay talk about, like, the actual, like, weird villain besides just comparing her. After. Yeah, besides, we're just like, it's kind of like Daredevil. Let's talk about literally everything else.
So obviously the villain was this blind woman, Vanessa, who did this to herself, basically. She blinded herself and it studied some sort of it's called Nanjin, but I'm not sure if it was like a martial art or I'm not sure if it was like a meditation or what it was meant to have been exactly. But basically she's enhanced all her other senses and strengths in order, you know, after becoming blind purposely becoming blind to go through this. And it is very, very much, as we said, like Daredevil, like she can sense things and see things with sound and all of that kind of stuff. Some of these fight scenes were really amazing because it's clearly that she could, like, detect things through heat and heartbeat, and so she would, like, not know where Angel was in front of her, which I thought was quite well done in some of the fights with her. And, yeah, she was sent – we saw her kill someone originally. Angel go into the court case to try and get it – you know, to try and get her actually charged by proving that she has reflexes by throwing her sunglasses back at her, which I thought was – amazing, and him being so frustrated that he couldn't do anything about this, you know, real villain, basically, like, I saw her murder someone and I can't do anything. Yeah, ultimately, that's what brings... go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I loved that, like, just that frustration in
Angel.
Yeah,
it's my favourite scene.
It's so good.
That he's so lost about, like, not being able to do anything, and, like, and it's great, and obviously... You know, she gets acquitted. Lindsay was defending her, and they find out that they want to use her for a worse job, one that may get her charged with insanity if she's caught, so she probably wouldn't get acquitted. She'd probably still go to some sort of facility, but they're worth using it, which is to kill these children who are psychic mind readers as well. They also blind like her, that will apparently pose a threat to Wolfram and Hart when they're older. So Lindsay and Angel end up being able to save the children, as well as the, you know, this is after the heist happens. And Angel, as I said, in those fights, if he doesn't move, she can't tell where he is because he has no heartbeat, no heat, which is very, very, very clever. So they have that big fight. Does she actually come out of it dead? I can't remember if they kill her or not.
I mean, he hits her with that stick thing and then they get the children out of there. I don't know if she was taken away or if she dies. I don't know. I might have to go back and rewatch it.
Well, the children survived.
The children survived. Like, he delivered, like, this, like, final blow that either took her down or killed her. Like, I'm not sure where, like, what kind of custody she could have gone into at that point.
Yeah. Do you feel like the children will be a part of the show in any way in the future?
Every writer's room is stale for story at some point, so maybe.
No, remember we had those children? Yeah, so this actual plot of this woman and her powers and that she was being used as an assassin by Wolfram & Hart. How did this work for any of you guys? What did you get from this? What did this tell you about the world of Angel, basically?
I think, like, it circles back to when we were saying, like, you know, how the monster, or, you know, in this case she's not, well, she is kind of a monster, like, you know, how they inform what's going on in the characters. Mm-hmm. And I think that this was a good example of using this person to kick off really ingraining the story in Wolfram Hart, like finding a way to get us really, like, they've been hinting at it and bringing us in with what's her name, Lila, and all that other stuff for like a couple weeks now. But now it's like, all right, we really need to drive this home in this episode. So they used this woman and this case to show the moral gray area of Lindsay and bring Lindsay into Angel's life and then give Angel this conflict of, there's sometimes I just can't always do right, and it would be so much easier if I was Angelus, because like then I wouldn't have to think about anything, and everything that was wrong I could just take care of, and I wouldn't have this conscious thing going on. And then, like, you know, it just, it brought a lot of things into play, and it gave Cordelia and Wesley a little bit of a break, but it still showed their importance, how Cordelia still has ties to the Buffy world and how she is really good at figuring things out where Wesley overthinks. And then Wesley is still really good at hitting the books and bringing that. So it showed, it gave like a really good overarching picture of where we are, where we're going into the finale, and then how things are going to proceed from there. So I really liked this episode of Angel a lot.
Cool. Anyone else got any particular thoughts about the villain and the actual case there and any of the moments involved in that?
No, I was just mad that nobody went on a date.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you get to do a musing last week? What were you expecting? Were you hoping that Angel went to go on an awkward date?
Yes. Well, I said that somebody sets up Cordelia and Angel like on a blind date, and they don't know it's each other.
Yeah. Oh my god, I would watch that show. I would watch the hell out of that show. But yeah. So the biggest thing as well, and again, Brittany, I didn't know if you want to talk about this in your quote or not, but what you mentioned about Angel and the line that you ended up picking was that moment of, that you mentioned, that having a conscience is, it muddies things, it makes the choices harder and stuff like that. And he compares that to the quote-unquote purity of not having a soul. Basically, that when you're evil, it's pure. Like, you know exactly what you want to do or why or whatever. Like, that, you know, that he said, you know, that he, your quote is the one about missing, having the clarity. Mm-hmm. It's just really interesting that that's like an ongoing, that's something that he's talking about. Again, if people will allow me to make another Supernatural reference, because I feel like there are a few people out there that probably watch both shows. When Dean came back from being in Purgatory, he said exactly the same thing. Like, that he was in this hell dimension basically for the equivalent of a year, and all he was doing was like fighting for his life and, you know, being completely animalistic. And he was like, he literally used the word pure. He was like, in a way it was, you know, it's back, I'm back, but it's, everything here is so complicated. Like, Purgatory was pure. And he talks about missing that. And that's just such a crazy concept, that like these characters are like, oh, I would prefer that life, that attitude, you know, if it means not having to have the trauma of making choices and feeling guilt and feeling stress and feeling all of these things. And I don't know. So my question for you guys is, would you rather have the purity of being evil or being animalistic, or would you rather have, you know, all of our crappy human emotions, given the choice?
Personally, I like my human emotions.
Yeah.
In Angel universe, I would like Angel to not have emotions and just be Angelus.
When he's at a safe distance on the TV.
Fair enough. So would you actually watch a show about Angelus? Like, what would it be? Like, if you could have a show about Angelus, like,
it would
literally
be Angelus
not having a
song. And Ripper taking on the world together, because they did obviously live at the same time.
And would it just be like humorous, oh, Angel, you can't be that evil. Now remember, we can't just go and be that naughty. Or would Angel be the villain?
No, Angelus would be the villain, and Ripper would be going after him. It would be amazing. Oh my gosh, can you imagine? I can't talk about it. It's too good.
Kristen, have you seen, you watch a lot of things that have magic and supernatural in it. Have you seen any other comparisons of this whole, like, state of purity with where you have, you know, the human stuff gets in the way and is a mess, and that people sort of crave the moments that are not like that? Like, has that happened on any of your shows?
Oh, yeah. That's like, yeah, the central Vampire premise Diaries of Vampire Diaries.
Yeah, I was like, gonna say, yeah, that I feel is, like, we're going somewhere here.
That's very
that's like
much
what's happening right now at this moment, yeah, on Vampire Diaries.
And it's well, happened at least four times before. Like, you've gone through this with Stefan and yeah, you've gone through this with Stefan and his Ripper side, which is very
isn't
different from Giles.
And, like, turn it off. Like, oh, I've got too many messy human emotions. Just gonna turn to, you know, turn my humanity off because I don't have yeah to deal with being like that. Like,
yeah, they turn it off. It's yeah a switch.
Yeah, and so they've gone through that before with different characters turning off their humanity and what that means for them, and they're all kind of different depending on who they are in their normal vampire state as opposed to who they are with their humanity turned off, and
yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, that's again, like, Supernatural in season 11 had this whole thing with people losing their souls with this villain that was, like, sucking souls to get strength. And you got a real variation of the people who were left soulless. Like, some of them without a soul were just like, they just didn't really care about anything. They were just like, oh, I used to have feelings and now I don't. And then some of them were, like, acting on their murderous impulses and stuff like that. So I feel like that's interesting as well, like, because obviously all of the vampires on this show, you know, they all lose their souls, but we've seen a degree of what that means for different vampires. You know, Spike, as an example, that, you know, does losing your soul automatically mean evil? I mean, they've obviously got this drive to attack, but yeah, it's just an interesting and seemingly universal concept, this whole preference of not having the messy emotions. All right, so going into favourite scenes and favourite lines of this episode, a lot of them have been touched on in the discussion, you know, like Brittany's, for example, which we'll get to in a moment. My favourite scene, again, we touched on was Angel reacting to that phone call about the court case that Vanessa got acquitted. His little breakdown there of just, like, frustration and grief, he's like, I can't do anything. Like, I can't do anything. I know she's guilty. She's a human. She murdered another human right in front of me. I cannot do anything. And he's just losing it. And I just loved it so much. It was such a fantastic little bit of acting, like such an, you know, such a moment from him that we haven't really seen before. And I just loved it. And Brittany, I think you mentioned loving it as well. But yeah. Ariana, what was your favorite moment from this episode and why?
Mine was Cordelia chatting on the phone with Willow, just because, well, I really liked that they were, like, on friendly terms, even though Willow crashed her, like, when Angel showed up at Thanksgiving. But I like that they're on friendly terms, and, I mean, we'll discuss my favorite line in a moment, but I just kind of liked Cordelia's whole attitude during that.
It's really interesting that they were being, like, you know, that Willow clearly wasn't being condescending to her or anything, because Cordelia was responding very well. We didn't hear Willow's side, but, you know, she was clearly giving her instructions and Cordy was like, okay. And it wasn't, like, bickering. It was, like, really, like, she accepted that Cordelia was apparently going to be doing some hacking and she was willing to help her with it. And it was really, really awesome. Brittany, how about you?
My favorite scene was, like, we talked about Angel talking with Lindsay, just because, like I said, that chemistry was just really there. And that scene was just, it felt so good. And Angel was so great in it, because, like, you think he's paying attention and he's acting all superior, and then he's he's so great at playing this role, and I love when he gets opportunities to really unleash that side of himself.
Yeah, he's so good at putting on, like, Angel himself putting on an act of being a badass, if you know what I mean, like putting on that really, like, I'm gonna be a heartless douchebag.
Yeah, and he doesn't need the jacket to do it.
And Angel is not a heartless douchebag, but, like, when he goes out and he, like, confronts someone about something, he's so good at playing that, like, bad boy man of the night. And I love that we see that that's not really him, that that's not him 24/7, that he actually puts that on as an intimidation tactic. And I love it. So he's a gorgeous silly little baby. I love him. I actually wrote in my show notes about the court case. I was like, poor hopeless baby, because he was so just bereft. But yes, Kristen, your favorite scene was the heist. Is that right?
Yes, it was basically everything from Angel welder guy cutting his way into like the basement from the sewer, all the way through him like tumble rolling out underneath the closing gate and just escaping, but you know, by the nick of it was just great. That whole thing just kind of is it's kind of a lost art. Like, I love the Mission Impossible aspect of like caper tales and all of that. So I love it when you get a character like Angel who's sneaky but not sneaky sometimes. And so watching him kind of go through all this was good fun.
I really loved it. So favorite lines. Mine was in the scene that Brittany just mentioned, when Lindsay is sitting there talking about, like, you don't know what it's like to be poor and to not have any opportunities. And then, you know, this fell into my lap. You don't get it. You don't get why I'm at this place. And Angel's just like, he kind of yawns. He's like, I'm sorry, I nodded off. Did you get to the part where you're evil? And I love this so much from both sides, because I loved the depth for Lindsay. I love that we can see realistically why that is. I love that we can see realistically why that has happened to him, and how, you know, how and why and all of those things, that he has this sad story about his life that he, you know, deserves sympathy apparently. And yet Angel is just sitting there going, cool motive, still murder, if you know what I mean, which I think is a really important thing that needs to be hammered home in more shows, more things, especially as people come to kind of love antagonists, they come to love anti-heroes that really don't deserve a pass, if you know what I mean. It's like, no, like, you know, you really don't deserve sympathy. It doesn't excuse that. I feel like there's a lot of fiction where people do excuse stuff that shouldn't be excused. And I love that Angel's like, yeah, don't care about how shitty your life was. You still made those choices, you know, to get where you are. You could have risen above that. And this is going to tie a little bit into Kristen's quote, I believe. Yeah, there was another quote somewhere in the episode about, like, again, like, choosing to do good, I think, which also really tied into it as well, that I loved. But I just love that moment from both sides of them. It was such a well-rounded moment. So
really interesting to see Angel's reaction in this episode, because I found it frustrating, because since he is so much like, this is about saving souls, and usually mm-hmm. he does try to redeem people, but he was just like not having it with Lindsay, and I was surprised that his reaction was so different compared to Faith, when Faith has also done really terrible things.
I think with him, with Lindsay, for example, the bit that I was talking about is later on in the episode, where he was like, oh, you might get killed. Angel's like, that's what we call an acceptable risk, which was hilarious. But he also says that thing, he's like, you're just here because you panicked and you didn't realize how deep you'd gotten in. That's not change. You have to make a decision to change. You do that by yourself and you have to live with it. And this is going to tie into the line Kristen picked. So I think that she should probably go next, and then we'll grab you two after her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mine is starts with Lindsay, and he says, I get myself killed, that'll convince you I've changed. And Angel says, it's a start. And yeah, I, going off of everything Natalie just kind of went off said, I really just like it because it perfectly illustrates like how far someone like Lindsay is going to have to go to earn Angel's respect. Like, so if I get myself killed, that's going to convince you. That's what I have to do. You know, how far do I have to go to prove that I'm not this horrible person? Like, I'm here and I'm looking for help. And, you know, if you were Angel, you'd have trouble trusting this guy too. You know, at the same time, you're looking at it from Lindsay's perspective, and he is reaching out for help because he does see that what they're trying to get him to do is wrong. So it's, yeah, just a very interesting scene. And that line specifically kind of stuck out to me.
Yeah. And I think that concept, that the whole, like, that Angel actually points out the difference between someone doing stuff for the good side to save their own skin, you know, because it lines up with them, or them doing something for the good side because they've decided that it's right, is very different. And I think that's something to watch with a lot of characters in this universe, which is why I was like, oh, I can't believe you picked that quote as a newbie. You don't know how much foreshadowing there is. But yeah, so that whole circumstance of, because we do see, like, Spike, for example, has only aligned himself with the guys so far because he wants you know, the benefit of what it would mean for him to survive, not because he actually believes in what they're doing. So, yeah, that's really, really crucial moment, I think, for the series. How about you, Brittany?
Mine was, you know, when Angel says that he really misses the clarity. At first, like, when I first picked that, I was like, oh, obviously this is my favorite quote because he's talking about Angelus. But as we were talking about it in the context of our discussion, I was like, oh, it's actually a lot deeper than I was initially, like, giving it credit for. And so it's still my favorite quote, but it's my favorite quote for a much better reason, I think.
But yes, I was excited that you got to, you know, relish a little bit of Angelus love again. And Ariana, what was your favorite?
Mine was when Willow asks Cordelia who's there with her, and she goes, no one, just Wesley, because that's like the story of his life.
I really want to know, like, what's gossiped about behind the scenes, like, you know, over in Sunnydale. Like, guys, like, why are they all hanging out? Like, so, you know, Cordy and, like, yet, you know, from our perspective, it's Cordy and Wes and Angel that look, like, more progressive and awesome, whereas Buffy and Willow and Xander are all, like, stuck in their ways.
Yeah, they're probably like, poor Angel. He has to deal with those two.
Okay, so that's the end of our discussion. We've got our, if you'd like to reach out and talk to us about anything we've talked about in this episode, again, the email address is rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com, and our Twitter is @re_watchable. This post on hyperball.com, you can reach us there, or rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. iTunes review. This is also a great way that you can let us know that you like us. If you rate us 5 stars, then Natalie, that's me, will set you up on an actual nice blind date, preferably one where you get to be the third wheel to Angel and Cordy. I would if I could, you guys. I really would. So, yeah, I can set you up on a blind internet date, I'm sure, with someone from Rewatchable or someone from Hyperball. Let's see how that goes. And we've got a little bit of listener feedback here. Does anyone want to just tackle this email? Ariana, we've got it's not an email, it's a comment from one of our listeners. So we've got one extensive comment to talk about this week.
Sure. It was long. I cut it down a little bit, but I recommend that you go back to Hyperball and read the bit. So this is from John Ricosta, and he said, so the question was, would I still watch the show if Buffy didn't have powers? Absolutely. The reason why I watch this show will forever be in my top 3 shows of all time is because of the relationship between Buffy, Willow, and Xander. I love how they interact with each other. I love each character, flaws and all. And then he goes on for a little bit about how they do things that might not seem forgivable, but he likes that for their growth and things like that. And then he finishes off by saying, can't wait to get past season 4, definitely one of the weaker seasons, but with lots of strong moments sprinkled throughout. Great job as always on the podcast. Love the differing and rational discussions amongst the podcasters.
That's nice. A lot nicer than Gail H.
John. That was a really nice, comment?
comment. Hyperbole
comment.
Sorry,
it's getting later. Yeah, it was a really nice hyperbole comment, and thank you for your input on why you love the show and love the character relationships.
One little correction. I believe that we are on episode 187, which was not changed. I said 187. I believe this is 188, as apparently last week was 187 as well.
It is 188.
No one changed that in the document that I was reading, so that's fine. Very, very quickly, Brittany's brainstorms, Ariana's assumptions, Buffy, 422, Restless, Angel, 122, to Shanshu in LA. Christian's considerations can also be taken as well. So anyone got anything at all about either of these finales based on the title?
I have got this. Okay, guys, I know exactly what's going to happen. So in Restless, the Buffy episode, everyone's feeling a little restless. And so then the trio shows up and it makes everyone feel even more restless. They're like, what's this? Why are these people friends? And it makes everyone really uncomfortable. And Buffy's like, why do you like Cordelia more than me? Why did you never make me pancakes? Where is my pancake? And Angel's like, I'm sorry, but I don't know. And then they Shanshu over to LA, and then the people, the Scooby gang, is over in LA, and they're like, Everything is so weird here. There's like clubs with demons and oh, maybe we should like open up our eyes and our perspectives. But yeah, and then Cordelia's like, hey, everyone, Shanshu away. And that's what happens.
Does Shanshu mean anything to you at all, the word contextually?
Not at all. It's probably in a different language, and I sound like just a terrible person. I'm sorry.
No, just checking, just wondering. I believe it is a fictional word, so I don't think that you are accidentally, you know, making a faux pas there. You'll see next week, I suppose. So that's it from us. This has been a bit of a long one, but we had some things to say, and also I wasn't really prepared to host, so I wasn't in the groove of actually moving us along very well. Sorry about that. We will leave you, and next week you'll get the finales of Season 4 and Season 1, our first crossover season that we've done of Buffy and Angel together. Hopefully you guys have enjoyed it. So until then, I'm Natalie.
I'm Arianna.
I'm Brittany.
And I'm Kristen.
Yay! Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.